The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Champions League returns with work to do for Liverpool and Tottenham as Jurgen and Jose get spiky. Just how good is the brass and is there any better sound in football than the rattling of the net from a thunderbolt? West Ham roll over in Manchester as the row between City and UEFA continues, while United's win at Chelsea leaves Lampard in a fight for fourth. There's more than one heavyweight fight in town. Prepare for Deschamps versus Cantona. We'll discuss Arsene Wenger's offside ideas, Barcelona's Braithwaite brain scrambler, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. As Max likes to say, we have a panel today. It would be a very boring podcast if we didn't. Good morning, Philippe Auclair.
Good morning to you, Faye.
How are you?
I'm not too bad. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Are you ready for a rant?
Oh, yeah, always. I've prepared a couple.
Jonathan Liu.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm all right. It's a little bit early for me. For someone who got back from Spurs at 1 a.m. last night.
It's a little bit early for all of us, but you have more reasoning than the rest of us. Barry, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Very well, thanks. You've got your head in your hands already. That's early.
Supply teacher Faye, looking forward to it.
I shall be bossy as ever. Right, let's start with the Champions League. Atletico Madrid 1, Liverpool 0. The first time, really, that Liverpool have lost with their full strength team, if you like, since the 17th of September when they lost 2-0 away at Napoli. Philippe, what happened?
Combination of things, an extremely hostile environment, a very aggressive Atletico de Madrid side that, honestly, I don't think I had seen playing at that kind of level, with that kind of intensity for quite a while. A certain lack of, clinicality. Is there such a word of clinicality? Of course there isn't. But of the killer instinct, as they say, in front of goal. It was not the most, it was not a bad performance by Liverpool by any means, but just perhaps a reminder how Diego Simeone still can put together a side that will give you absolute hell in their own stadium. Also, quite a lot of bit of shithousery, I think. I think we all agreed on that. But not a scandalous result at all, and not one which genuinely threatens Liverpool. They're not out of the competition by any means. I think the proportion is something like 39% of teams which have lost 1-0, blah, blah, whatever it means. We're talking about the champion of Europe. But just a little stumble rather than anything else. Some players who, again, I think when they approached the 30 yards, suddenly some of the confidence which marks their play elsewhere on the pitch, in terms of the transmission of the ball or the way they control it, they seem to lose a little bit of their maestria. And for that reason, when you're up against a team that was as well drilled and as aggressive as Atletico, and honestly, and I've seen Atletico a few times in La Liga this season, I've never seen play them at this level.
Yeah, they were so organised, weren't they, Johnny? It was an impressive standing from Diego Simeone, a sloppy start from Liverpool, which we're not used to seeing.
Yeah, and once Atletico got that early goal, it was almost like seeing that the Atletico of old. I mean, they've had to sort of modify their style a little bit in La Liga. They're a lot more used to playing with a lot of possession, a lot of flair, some flair. But this was, you just felt something like the old muscle memory kicking in, and you could see Simeone on the touchline going, absolutely batshit crazy. And, the crowd really getting into it. And it was proper sort of backs to the wall, rear guard display. And I think, getting that early goal really set not just the game up, but a whole tie. Because I think Liverpool are pretty certain that they're going to go to Anfield and turn them over. But Atletico will also feel that if in a low scoring tie, they have all the cards.
Yeah, they certainly do. Sal Niguez with the goal. There's kind of no legislating for it, though, Barry, really, is there? It comes through a group of players, bounces off Fabinho, catches everybody out apart from him. But what was interesting was Klopp afterwards talking about the throw-in, like three phases before the corner that should have been Liverpool's that then led to that. And that's what he was complaining about.
Yeah, and it was a legitimate complaint, but, defend the corner.
Exactly.
There were four Atletico players in the box, nine Liverpool players in the box, and an Atletico scored. So Klopp and a couple of his players have been getting sort of grief for cry arson after the defeat. And I can kind of understand that they are so used to winning that it must be, you know, it's like getting a punch in the nose just to, oh, crikey, we lost. And watching Virgil van Dijk and Andy Robertson afterwards, they seemed quite put out that Atletico hadn't done the decent thing and let them score or beat them, you know. Klopp as well. And they 1-0 isn't a bad result for Liverpool. They could have come away on the end of a 2 or 3 nil defeat, because Atletico missed a couple of decent chances. Liverpool didn't force Oblak to make a single save in the whole game. So I would say, on the face of a poor performance by their own very high standards, 1-0 is a decent result.
Yeah, Liverpool had almost 73% of possession for large parts of the game, which we probably all were expecting. It felt like Atleti just kind of sat back, kept their shape. Is the key to playing Liverpool just sitting very deep? And if so, why haven't other teams tried that?
I think quite a few teams have tried that and failed spectacularly. Not everybody is as well organised as this particular Atletico side. And Liverpool is not necessarily a side that feels very much at ease in win possession. I mean, one thing which is quite striking, for example, I think they've scored something like 4 goals from corner kicks for the opposition. So they're extraordinarily quick in transition and counter-attacking. And they're in a game where there is space and a game where there is a kind of a ding-dong battle going from one corner, kind of basketball game, they're almost unbeatable. Actually, they are unbeatable at the moment. In this kind of game against an opponent which is that well prepared, it's much more difficult. It's not the first time that they've had difficulties scoring or this season. The difference is that usually, whatever the questions they are asked, and they've been asked a lot of questions by a lot of teams, they generally find an answer, and this time the answer was not forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And perhaps due to the fact that some of their front players perhaps lack a little bit of sharpness. I keep thinking Mo Salah really blows hot and cold a lot this season. Then there was the thing that when he decided to take off Sadio Mane, and which I think is a bit, I mean, I don't think it's a first. Probably managers have done that before because they feared that the player was being targeted by the opposition, but that's a very big call to make, and which also has shown that, you know, David Carragher perhaps is not the kind of player that you want to have in this kind of situation, even though he's a wonderful and very efficient and very useful player.
Yeah, he defended himself on that, Klopp. Mm. He said the plan tonight was to get Sadio out of the game with a second yellow card, and I was afraid that Sadio's opponent would go down if he took a deep breath on him or something. I don't want to have this situation. That's why I took him off. And he also, you mentioned earlier on about the atmosphere at the Metropolitana, and Klopp criticised the referee a lot, seemingly implying that he was affected by the crowd.
Well, I don't know what to say when other managers say this sort of thing. I say it's rubbish, so why shouldn't I say exactly the same thing? Because it's Jurgen Klopp.
He also then said, "Welcome to Anfield," which, yeah. Yeah, and when it comes to using the fervour of a home crowd to try and to addle the minds of whether it's the opposition or whether it's a referee, then, you know, Liverpool are the masters of that particular playbook.
Mm, so 1-0 at half time, if you like, the tie perfectly poised. But surely Atletico have to score at Anfield if they want to progress, because you can't see Liverpool not scoring at Anfield.
I can. Against Atletico, I can see them not scoring. But if Atletico were to take a lead at Anfield, that would give Liverpool all sorts of problems. But again, they won't be too perturbed by that result. If I was a Liverpool fan, I would take it as a positive and just reflect on the fact it could have been worse.
Maybe if you look at it, I mean, I tend to be more positive with most things. And if you do look at it in terms of Liverpool have been cruising across the season, perhaps it's a little wake up call that they might have, you know, perhaps needed. And then when you look at what happened in the Champions League last year, this rebuild that Atletico are going on at the moment, you wonder whether or not Simeone will learn the lessons from Turin last season when they went, you know, to Juventus with a decent lead and then got turned over and punished. So from both those points of view, you know, both sides are going to be up for it, surely, at Anfield.
Yeah, I mean, I was at that game in Turin last year, and it was kind of startling to see how the way that Atletico folded under pressure. I mean, Ronaldo had an incredible night, but he was the way that they were conceding goals was extremely un-Atletico. They were doing it from crosses and they were failing to clear set pieces. And these are the sort of things that they've traditionally done so well. I mean, you talked about teams sitting deep against Liverpool. And yes, a lot of teams have tried to sit deep and pack men behind the ball. But by and large, the teams who've been trying to do that in the Premier League, you know, by definition, aren't going to be very good. It's very rare that you come across a team that is so good at playing this sort of football and has the, you know, the elite personnel that can pull it off. I think it's going to be an amazing second leg. It's going to be loud and it's going to be horrible. There's going to be at least 12 yellow cards. There's going to be play acting and
it's going to be shithousery
at his best.
It's going to be El Shithouse.
I love a bit of El Shithouse.
But the thing you were saying, they've been cruising. I don't think they've been cruising in that many games that I can remember. I remember them having some very beautiful victories and so forth, scoring some wonderful goals and so on. But most games of Liverpool I've seen, they've always had moments where they were not quite put. I mean, like even at Tottenham.
Yeah, they've not been destroying teams. I think something like half of their wins in the league, around half of their wins in the league, have come by one goal.
But they're still winning, and that's the point, and that's what they weren't doing.
Yeah, but
I think in
England it's now come to the point that teams, clubs, when they play Liverpool, they're going to be champions. They're playing against the reputation as much as against the team, and you do get a feeling that there is perhaps not the same kind of incredible spirit that was inhabiting Atletico. Whereas Atletico in La Liga, their season is more or less done. I mean, yeah. The title, there's no hope of that. This is all for the Champions League. Let's go there. Let's go and get not only a result, but to show, you know, the rest of Europe what kind of a club, what kind of a team we are. And they didn't play against a reputation. They actually set out to destroy a reputation.
Could this be their turning point?
In La Liga, I don't think it will make any difference, honestly. And I don't think it's a turning point for Liverpool either. I mean, like Barry said, it's just a defeat on the road. What's so terrible about that? 1-0 away, well, against a team that was not so long ago in the Champions League final.
I just hope, for the sake of my own personal entertainment, that Atletico go ahead at Anfield. That would make for an absolute belter of a tie. If they were to go, you know, 2-0 up on aggregate with an away goal after 10 minutes, that would be, or 15 minutes, that would be superb.
Right, Tottenham Hotspur 0, RB Leipzig 1. So both finalists from last year's Champions League, 1-0 down at the halfway stage. And, I mean, just a goal in it, but really, Spurs should feel very lucky to keep it just to the one goal. Jonathan, you were there. You didn't get home till 1 a.m. this morning. How lucky were Spurs?
It was a 1-0 thrashing. They were extremely lucky. Werner's penalty was the only goal, but frankly, they could. I mean, I think Tottenham could have been 3 down within about 90 seconds. Mm-hmm. There was a full-on assault on the Tottenham goal right from kickoff. Leipzig hit the post. There was an incredible chance that I think Schick missed in the second half. Mm-hmm. And you know, Tottenham did have some chances of their own. They sort of came on quite strongly towards the end in the, you know, the same way they did against Liverpool and Manchester City. After sitting back for most of the game, when they had to chase it, they chased it quite well. And I suppose they'll pin their hopes on what happened against Ajax in the semi-final, where they were totally outplayed for 90 minutes. And actually, they were totally outplayed for 135 minutes and then just sort of broke them down in the last 45. And the big difference between those two sides is that Tottenham, they don't have Kane, they don't have Heung-min Son, but they did have big Fernando Llorente, who, and if you look at the last 10 minutes of that second leg against Ajax, they just booted it up to Llorente and picked up the second balls. How they're going to, you know, even attempt to do that against Leipzig with Lucas and Bergwijn and, you know,
They could play, I don't know, Toby Alderweireld, that's number nine or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, Davinson Sanchez. Being made of the fact that Tottenham don't have a centre-forward, when in fact they do have a centre-forward, he's an 18-year-old called Troy Parrott, who Jose Mourinho refuses to give any game time to.
He says he's not ready.
How does we know? I mean, I'm not sure. Obviously, Jose sees him every day, or if he's presuming he's training with the senior squad, throw him in.
I don't believe he exists.
No, he does. I have seen him in training, so he definitely does exist. But what I would say is, if he's not ready, why are you not sending him out on loan to get him ready?
Yeah. Well, he is a centre forward. You know, he has experience. He's not. It's not like you're picking someone out of the crowd because they're tall to go and play, you know, up front for us. I can't see the harm in it. The crowd would love to see him come on. He would have, you know, the full support of the home crowd. And I'm not banging the Parrott drum because he's Irish, but he is a good young player and he is a centre forward. Spurs are crying out for a centre forward.
And what is even more extraordinary is the fact that they were playing against an RB Leipzig team which was missing three defenders which should be in their starting 11, including the guy who's been the rock on which their defence has been based all season, which is Upamecano. And they had, you know, it was a very inexperienced RB Leipzig team. And actually, after the game, talking to some of German colleagues who were at White Hart Lane Mark II, they said RB Leipzig played well, but they didn't play that well compared to the way they can play, and they were not at their absolute best. It's just in front of them, Tottenham were at their absolute worst. And I'm also wondering, you know, all these mind games, the fact that before the game, Mourinho was already talking about how he was missing these players and these players. It was almost like a backs to the wall, impossible task. He's talking about RB Leipzig here.
It's their debut at this. At the knockout
absolutely,
stage,
which is
it?
Also, by the way, makes me think that Spurs do have a chance, because just like Ajax. Yeah. Last year, they're playing against a team that has never been in this situation before, in terms of age, of course, this age group. So there is something to play for. But I mean, the difference was, I mean, it was so stunning to see the difference between a well-drilled side, a very well-drilled side, and a side that had absolutely no shape whatsoever. And I know people have said he's only been here, you know, for a few months. He hasn't had the time. But I thought that his greatest quality was the capacity to organise a squad, a side very quickly. And it's not a question just of personnel. It's a question of, you could see how the mechanics of RB Leipzig was working. You could see exactly what they were doing. You could see, I mean, I was really struck by that. Angelino.
Yeah.
Was at Manchester City not that long ago. He's a Manchester City player on loan. And you thought, he's okay, but nothing special. He had an absolutely magnificent game. He's actually played two Bundesliga games and one Pokal game before this one. He already knew absolutely everything. Where to run, when to drop back, how to combine with every single one of his teammates. In front of him, I'm sorry, that was not a rubbish team. They might be missing Son and Kane, but you look through the team and you look through what they've got on the bench and you think, I'm sorry, there is no excuse there.
When you look at Leipzig, there were so many standout performances. Special mention, though, to Ethan Ampadu.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
19 years old, second start for the club, completed 93 of his 98 passes and had an absolutely terrific game. Timo Werner as well, in particular, had some great chances, just 23 years old.
And the feint for the Schick, chance was absolutely superb.
Mm. Yeah, Werner was really good. I hadn't seen a huge amount of him. First time I've seen him live. And he's one of those strikers, one of those centre-forwards that doesn't really seem to play in the centre-forward role at all. He pops up in the centre midfield, he pops up on the left wing, and yet when it gets to the business end of a move, somehow he's always there.
Linked a lot with Liverpool. Would he fit there?
I think so. He was asked about it after the game and said he was very flattered by Liverpool's interest and who wouldn't be, etc., etc. And did I read somewhere this morning that he said, maybe I'm not ready for them yet? Which I wouldn't necessarily agree with that.
Shows a lot of maturity, though, to come out and say that.
Yeah, I'm not 100% certain he said that, but I did read this morning that he said it. But I suppose maybe he's looking at Liverpool's forward line and going, well, who would I get in ahead of? But there is talk that possibly Roberto Firmino might leave Liverpool this summer. So.
Interesting. Let's talk Jose Mourinho post-match interview. I mean, I did want to mention with the Troy Parrott thing, we've seen Mourinho do this before. Diversionary tactics. Could we potentially see Troy Parrott starting against Chelsea at the weekend? Have you know?
Yeah, he'll get 90 minutes, and they'll stick him up front on his own with nobody within 30 yards of him. And then afterwards, Mourinho will go look. Look, I gave him a go, and he's rubbish.
Yeah, very spiky. Asked whether or not the second half improvement was, in inverted commas, the real Spurs, to which he replied, "What do you mean by the real Spurs? This is our situation. It's like going into a fight with a gun without bullets. We're in a very difficult situation, so I am so proud of the players, but what worries me is this is going to be the situation until the end of the season." Obviously key personnel out with Kane, and now Son fracturing his arm during that Villa game, which I was astounded because I was at that game, and he came out and he did all his post-match press interviews, and he'd actually suffered that fracture after 20 seconds of that game and then played and scored twice. And I mean, that's crazy.
Maybe you should have played him then. Sorry.
Well, why can't he play for the rest of the season?
It's a very good point.
I commend his courage, because I'd be crying like a baby.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be such a massive problem though for Spurs.
Well, in terms of the league in particular, that's a huge, huge loss. They've been able to cope in the past with losing either Kane or Son. But generally what happened, I remember it was last season when Kane was injured for quite a while, and Son, who, you know, was not exactly as physically fit as he should have been because he had a very complicated start to the season with playing for his country and so forth. And he stepped in and he was scoring the goals for them. So yes, it is a huge problem for him.
But they tend to flip flop, don't they? When one's injured, one comes in and scores. But then, you know, when Kane comes back, Son tends to go quite quiet.
Yeah. I mean, Lucas is basically their only legitimate option up front. I mean, he's a very good player, but he's 5'7". Mm. He's not as good as either Kane or Son at finding space in the area. He's obviously not as good in the air. And Dele Alli, who's I guess the other player who can play in that advanced role and is quite good in the air. He's basically him and Lucas are basically going to be their goal threat for the next few weeks, few months.
Mm. That's it for part one. Coming up, we're going to be looking at the rest of the Champions League action from this week.
Too often in science podcasts, we hear voices not of the people who might be affected by new discoveries, but of those who made them. What if we flip that on its head?
Like, my father's 50 and praise God that he's still alive, but that's through kidney transplant, ripping a vein out of his leg to put in his arm. That's through having 8 units of blood every month, and that's touch and go if he actually gets that. This could stop that.
With our Common Threads podcast, we travelled around the country to hear people's questions, hopes and fears when it comes to something called gene editing. It's a technology that could one day allow us to rewrite our DNA.
Actually, my son has severe learning difficulties, so he doesn't have capacity to make any decision for himself. I'd say that he's very happy in his skin. The only person that has suffered because of him is me. Would I change him if I could? No.
My daughter's got an extra chromosome, and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her, it's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
It's important as well to give context, because we're all here and we're all people of African origin, and I think that very much shapes our response to things like this, because our history of being abused by science shapes us.
To have a listen, just search Common Threads on your podcast app, or head over to theguardian.com, where you'll find all the content from our Gene Gap project.
Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have some live shows for you, March the 9th and the 10th. Glasgow University Debating Chambers, sounds very posh. Lars Sivertsen and Philippe Auclair, a few tickets remaining for that, so get on and book those. On the 10th, it's at the Pleasance Theatre in Edinburgh with Lars Sivertsen again and Ellis James, and that one is sold out. 23rd of March, we're at Earth in London, and the 9th of April, back up in Leeds. Those lineups are TBC. Right. Borussia Dortmund 2, PSG 1. This didn't really spark into life until the second half. But, I mean, there's no way we can not start this game talking about the youngster, the brat. You're doing some kind of dance here, Philippe, to my right. What are you doing?
I was thinking, I know, it's because obviously I watched the game from a very, I suppose, Francocentric perspective. And it was everything I was hoping for.
A PSG defeat.
Yes. Sorry, no, I shouldn't say that. Yes, but no, he's a bit special. But I think we're aware of that.
Yeah, gushing praise for him. It is worth repeating.
I don't think we even need to give his name. I think everybody knows who you're talking
about. I haven't
even
said it yet, and we all know. So Erling Braut Haaland, 2 goals. And let me just read out his stats because they're so impressive. 10 goals in 7 Champions League games this season. More goals than Barcelona in the Champions League. 11 goals in just 450 minutes in a Dortmund shirt since his move in January. That's a goal every 41 minutes. He won Player of the Month in the Bundesliga despite playing just under an hour of football in January. And oh my goodness, that second goal, left-footed rocket, and the sound it made when it hit the net. That rattle is just gorgeous.
It's like music, a really good ball hitting the net. It's something in the tension of the net and sort of the mechanics of the goal, and you know, the pins and the attachments all sort of at exactly the right frequency. It's like a musical instrument if you play it right.
This is why you're a writer.
This isn't why.
Also, this Buddha celeb as well, and he's just a joy, isn't he?
I don't think he's ready.
Maybe not. Go and ask Jose what he thinks.
Oh my goodness.
Mbappe and Neymar, your favourite. Barry, linking up for the equaliser.
I mean, the thing about Haaland is he's on the same pitch as Mbappe and Neymar, two of the best players in the world, in the opinion of some. This jury remains out on Neymar. But
in monetary terms.
Yeah, and he's completely stolen their thunder. I mean, absolutely stolen their thunder. And they were reduced to cameos. Mbappe didn't have a particularly good game, although he did play a role in the goal. But PSG have it all to do in the second leg. And I mean, if they were to go out at this stage again, I would imagine it would not go down well with the powers that be in Gay Paris.
And in Doha.
And in Doha, yes.
Philippe.
Slightly less gay Doha.
you almost have like a look of relish on your face.
I shouldn't know otherwise, because I mean, I'm already trolled by fans of so many clubs, especially at the moment. I have more trolling coming from PSG fans. I'll just say one thing about Haaland is that there's one thing that disturbs me a bit about him, is that it genuinely looks like he's come out of the cast of Starship Troopers. And it is frightening. He looks like that.
He's like a fast bowler who bowls off the wrong foot.
Yeah.
Every step he takes looks like it's with the other foot. And I don't quite know how to explain it, but he runs in a way that you can't really predict, even though he's running incredibly fast in a direction that, you know, it's clearly a conventional running direction.
Forwards,
yeah. But, and I suppose that's what puts defenders off, because first of all, he's so quick, but also he's got this sort of weird syncopated running style, which makes it so hard to track his movement.
So it's unpredictable.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if that does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I do know exactly what you mean, but that's what probably makes him quite special, isn't it? Because, and that's what you get with the benefit of youth as well. You get somebody who you've not been able to analyse that deeply. Mm. They're coming up with new stuff all the time. They're full of confidence. They've got nothing in their brain saying you can't do this. They're just like, you know, full on. Neymar's comments after the game, you know, we can heap so much praise on Haaland and Dortmund, but you know, from a PSG point of view, Neymar comes out and is pretty much unhappy with the club after the game, blamed them for not preparing him enough after his latest injury. This kind of Neymar PSG thing, it increasingly feels like it's bad vibes.
There's so many bad vibes coming from the club at the moment. Not that it's particularly new. It seems to be one of those clubs, those teams. It doesn't matter what they do, everybody's unhappy. I think they could win everything inside. They would still find a reason to be unhappy. It's very, very odd. And perhaps that's what ultra domination of a league does to you. And also the way that they present themselves. But yes, I mean, he said basically, I was ready to play. Before the medical staff at PSG actually decided otherwise, but I'm not happy with that. Then you've got, of course, we shouldn't forget that Thomas Tuchel, that was the big comeback to Borussia Dortmund, a very important game for him, completely fluffed it, decided to use a formation, if you can call it, which was a kind of 3-4-3 with Di Maria, Mbappe and Neymar up front, which was supposedly going to give the wing backs, you know, Kozawa, I mean Meunier in particular, some license to go up front, and it was a complete disaster. And he'd only used this formation once in the whole season, and that was in a French Cup game against Dijon that nobody really cared much about. And suddenly, out of nowhere, he decides to use it, and he's come under incredible criticism in France for that. And when you know that it's all about the Champions League, as far as he's concerned, yes, it's troubling, and also the words he used after the game, talking about the fear in his players. My goodness, this is exactly the thing that we've been talking about when we talk about PSG for years. The fact that every single time that we expect them to do something, they actually fail to do it. They will have from time to time, okay, they will win this game against Barcelona, and then they will be completely flattened. In the return leg, and they lose against Manchester United. What on earth is going on here? And it seems every time, it's the opposite. Liverpool, you ask them questions, they get the answers. PSG, you ask questions, they leave the room. So it gives you an idea of the atmosphere there. Loads of talk about Mbappe as well. People saying that he's changed, his personality has changed, he's not pulling in the team's direction as much as he used to. Add to that Verratti, who is a superb player, I absolutely love him, who manages to get booked and will miss the return leg. Crucial player. How they're going to replace him, I have no idea. It's not a happy place at all.
I mean, this is more of a question than a point, really. I mean, why has the Champions League proven so hard to buy? You know, you see PSG, Manchester City, even Chelsea, who took, I think, you know, 8 or 9 years to win it in the most un-Chelsea way possible, and it just seems like there's been one first time winner of the Champions League in I think about 23 years, which is kind of insane when you think about all the new money that's come into the sport, that it's the same legacy clubs that seem to win it and seem to do well in it and seem to be reaching finals and semi-finals, even a fairy tale story like Ajax. They're still Ajax, and I wonder if there's a kind of almost a collective, a muscle memory, an institutional memory that kind of militates against certain clubs doing well in the competition and reassures the clubs that have been doing well. You know, Real Madrid, obviously the classic example, that have had historical success in it. I'll maybe throw it open, like why PSG have struggled so much.
You could add Liverpool to the list as well. I mean, all those clubs, of course, are part of the super elite and they're in the top 20 of Deloitte. Mm. But it's true that there seems to be this... I mean, Real Madrid fans are very keen on reminding everybody that Europe is different. Europe is about a culture and a tradition, and that if you don't have it, well, you're not going to get it. And that it seems to apply... Well, PSG is a case in mind, but I think there's a kind of neurosis, actually, that sets in. And perhaps... It's the negative side of it that we should look at. The fact that if you've never done anything in Europe, you have this fear factor, this pressure that you don't normally have. And it's only over two legs, obviously. Over a league, you know, I've seen PSG play some absolutely awful games, far worse than the ones against Borussia Dortmund. But there's always one way to compensate for that. And since you're so much better than the others, you'll be fine in the end. In this particular case, no. It's 180 minutes and that's that.
It's a really interesting point to make, especially when you look at the two debutants in the knockout stages in RB Leipzig and then Atalanta, you know, beating Valencia 4-1, that they're coming in and kind of shaking things up a little bit, if you like. This was a cracking game, actually, particularly from Atalanta's point of view. Two goals for Hatteberg. Ilicic's goal was gorgeous. Freuler's was even better. Serie A's top scorers, 63 goals in 24 games, 17 more than the leaders Juventus, and four on their first ever Champions League knockout game. Pretty extraordinary.
It's a nice story, the Atlanta story. The smallest team in left in the competition by distance. They're probably one of the best run teams. Little town where I believe a third of the population were at the game. Now, obviously, it's not in their own stadium. They're playing the San Siro, which is 70 or 80 kilometres away, I think. And I was saying to Jonathan before we started recording, when you consider that, you know, probably at least 20% of the population is either too old or too young to go to the game. That is a lot of people taking an interest. An emphatic victory. They played really well. Valencia didn't look up to much, and I would be astonished if Valencia were able to turn this around.
Even if Cherichev's goal, just there's a tiny element, you think it's going to be and that's going to be a cracker as well in terms of atmosphere coming back to Valencia. It's going to be absolutely wonderful. The thing is that it's taken them time, but not that much time, to get into European gear. We were talking about those clubs, which in a way are inhibited by fear, these new clubs. Perhaps the fact that precisely they're a small club makes the fear factor disappears. I think their revenue for the year ending 31st of December 2018, because that's the way it works in Italy, it's not over season, it's over the actual calendar year, it's under 100 million euros, which is far less than any Premier League team. Far less. It's actually more than some French teams, which are in the second part of the table at the moment. So it is exceptional. It's, as you say, it's an exceptionally well-run club, because out of a turnover of something like 100 million euros, they had 35 million profit. So obviously they're doing something really well.
Let's move on to the Europa League. Olympiacos against Arsenal tonight feels like deja vu for a number of different reasons, including this question I'm about to pose. Put your hand up who wants to answer it. Will Arsenal be looking at this competition as their best bet of making it to the Champions League next season?
Yes, is probably the answer, regardless of what happens elsewhere in Lausanne.
For all the modest improvements and subtle improvements they've made under Arteta, they're still nowhere near good enough to reach the top four, even in a historically weak year. I think something like, if Chelsea are on their current trajectory, they'll end up with something like 60 points and finish in the top four, which is kind of unheard of when you think that teams have generally been getting 70 and 75 and not making it. But that, you know, and even though they're, you know, the defence seems to have tightened up a bit, there's a little bit more solidity to them, and the goals have started flowing as they showed against Newcastle. They're still not good enough to reach the top four.
How many times is it that Arsenal has played against Olympiakos in the European competition?
I know, I was looking for this stat. It seems to be every year, doesn't
every
it?
Every year, yes.
Yeah, very much. Wolves entertain Espanyol. We all thought that they're going to struggle with the Thursday-Sunday combination of football, which they did at the beginning of the season, but they're certainly not now. They're thriving, Barry.
Yeah, I honestly think the Europa League is a tournament they could win, and I think they should go all out to try and win it. I thought they would struggle in the league if they gave the Europa League their full attention, but they're just a terrific team, and I suppose it might be down to their poor start, as I recall, but I think they should be in the top four. I mean, whenever I see them play, I think there aren't too many teams in the league better than them. Liverpool, City, and not many others. I can't really think of one off the top of my head.
Leicester, the first half of the season, perhaps, and that's about it, really. It's just they're still paying the price of, I think, I can't remember how many draws they had, consecutive draws at the beginning of the season, something like four or five, and which has, you know, hampered them throughout the season. But I'm with Barry on this one, and they have a genuine chance in that competition.
And the team have been together a while, which really helps. You can tell that on the pitch. Two Scottish sides also in Europa League action tonight. Copenhagen will entertain Celtic. Rangers play host to Sporting Braga. Manchester United go away to Club Brugge as well for their knockout tie. Of course, that straight off the back.
Club Brugge.
No, it isn't. So,
really?
Yeah. So
Club Brugge.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I promise you, because I voiced the Europa League highlight show and having for years said Club Brugge. Every time my producer's like, you know it's Brugge. I'm like, but it just doesn't sound right.
Is that a classic example of mansplaining?
Yeah. I'll forgive him for that. Bursa,
and yet the film is in Bruges.
Yes.
It's not in Brugge.
I agree.
But what is strange, it's a Flemish, speaking town, in majority which is Brugge. And but people call it by its French name.
But you are preaching to the converted here, because I would always say Bruges, but I have been reliably informed, and it is the official Europa League show that I voice, that it's Club Brugge, and that is what I'm going to say.
Well, I now feel about 2 inches tall.
Well, I'm sorry, Barry, that wasn't my intention, I promise you. I have also felt like that when people have said it to me, so I apologise. I hate being that person, the pernickety person. Anyway, Manchester United going to
Belgium.
That club to Belgium. Well done. Straight off the back of that 2-0 win at Chelsea. Martial and Maguire on the score sheet for United. The big question, should Harry Maguire even have been on the pitch? That studs up in, I don't really know how else to describe it apart from Michy Batshuayi's bits, which Frank Lampard called a universally wrong decision.
It was a fantastic excuse. I mean, it's one of the great footballing excuses from Maguire. He was interviewed afterwards and he said, I saw him, he was about to fall on me, so I just straightened my leg. as if, you know, it was an involuntary reflex. I was reminded of that game about Newcastle-Leicester game about 20 years ago when Alan Shearer appeared on replay to kick Neil Lennon in the face. And I think his explanation afterwards was, oh, my foot was trapped and I was just trying to free it. I was just trying to free my leg. And I happened to free it extremely quickly in the direction of Neil Lennon's face.
Do you remember when, as kids, you used to do that flying spaceship thing where you used to put your legs straight and then hold someone's arms and then fly them above you? It was a bit like him trying to say that's what he was trying to do.
Yeah. And Solskjaer said he was trying to protect himself. I was at the press conference. That's exactly the word he used, to protect himself.
But the ridiculous thing is they referred that to the video assistant, and it was cleared. And so whose fault is that, really?
Frustrating when you say what's the phrase reckless endangerment or something like that, and that was the decision.
Reckless endangerment of, well, they say reckless endangerment of life, you know, and it's clearly that there is potential life in that area.
Yeah, well, it's a very good point. 2 goals ruled out for Chelsea, critical moments of the game as well. The offside is obviously offside, but did anybody think that the decision on the Zuma goal was a little bit harsh? Just to remind you, if you missed it, Aspilicueta was penalised for pushing Brandon Williams.
But he was himself pushed a little bit by Fred. Yeah. So Fred pushed him. He then, almost as an involuntary reflex, puts his arms out and shoves
Was he protecting himself?
Yeah, he did it in self-defence.
Like dominoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, in Chelsea's last 14 games, they've won just 15 points. Are we at the point where Frank Lampard himself is going to get some kind of vitriol from the fans? Just 2 wins in the last 7 league games at home.
I can see, well, I think there were minor rumblings of discontent in that game. And I think the fact that he's Frank Lampard will only last so long, or, you know, keep the fans sweet
for so long. Yes, but
you know, Chelsea are entitled to feel aggrieved by some of the decisions that went against them in that game. But the fact of the matter is they didn't play well and they deserved to lose. They were a home side. They didn't look like the home side. They can't defend set pieces. They can't score. And I would say, you know, it's his first season in charge at a big club. It's a big job for Lampard, and he's doing just about okay. But nothing more.
Are we at that point now where, because the transfer ban has been lifted, that kind of stay of execution has passed and it is actually now on performances?
It's all a bit paradoxical because many people said that this registration ban was actually a good thing for Chelsea because it had enabled them to give a chance to young players. And that these young players had actually delivered the goods. And suddenly it's becoming, now the results are not as happy as they were during the autumn. We're seeing that as being a problem. I'm not too sure about that. I mean, there are things, two things. First, Frank Lampard himself has been, I think, very honest about the problems that he's meeting at Chelsea. And for a few games, he's not trying to put a positive spin on things. He recognizes that there are problems. He recognizes that there's a lot of work to do, particularly when it comes to finishing. He recognizes that things are not as they should be, so that's good. But on the other hand, I mean, there's a question. I was at the game, and I was wondering why on earth they've refused to let Olivier Giroud go. Why isn't it on the pitch when he's a proven goal scorer in big games, in big competitions, and Batshuayi has shown his limits yet again.
He was
Giroud
awful.
Comes on the pitch. And actually has this goal disallowed, which was actually a fantastic finish, but the goal disallowed. And also, I can't remember whom he put straight on goal by absolutely superb flick, and created in about 15 minutes more than Batshuayi had in 75. And you think, well, there is also a moment when you can start to discuss some of the choices that Lampard has made. Some Chelsea fans don't quite understand what's happening to Fikayo Tomori, for example. They don't understand why Azpilicueta is playing on the wrong side for him and that it's really hindering their efforts when they're going up the pitch, because Aspi is a wonderful player, one of the best right-backs in the history of the Premier League. He should be on the right. And so there are loads of questions here, and which are... The results are not there anymore. The performances are not quite there anymore. And it's normal that he would find himself the butt of some criticism and some hard questioning.
Just one other thing to mention from the Chelsea-Manchester United game. There was a need for another somber statement after the match. Chelsea saying that a large group of Manchester United supporters were making homophobic chants. Chelsea prevented a number of them entering the stadium and ejected more during the game. They said those supporters will be banned from attending matches at Stamford Bridge in future, and in cooperation with Manchester United, we've passed the details of those supporters to them so they can take appropriate action. United then responded by saying, "Our fans were vocal as always in their support for the team on Monday night, and we appreciate that loyal backing. However, this song directed against Chelsea FC or any other club by some of our fans runs counter to our values. We will continue to engage in campaigns to raise awareness and fight discrimination in all forms." The PA news agency understands that the FA take Chelsea's report seriously. They remain in regular and ongoing discussions with the police, Kick It Out, and the Crown Prosecution Service on what language is deemed discriminatory, but they're not going to be investigating the matter further. Right, one other game from the week to discuss, and that was last night's 2-0 win, Manchester City over West Ham. Rodri and Kevin De Bruyne on the score sheet. Can't help but think that those West Ham fans who made the journey up on a weeknight for a rescheduled game just to watch their team get pretty easily beaten, swatted aside, if you like, and not put up much resistance is not really a great train trip up from London, is it?
No, I wouldn't imagine they travelled with much hope anyway, but the defeat seems to have been sort of monotonously predictable. Could have been worse. West Ham are a mess on the pitch and off, and considering some of the fixtures they have coming, it's very hard to see how they're going to extricate themselves from that mess.
Manchester City, 77% possession, 20 shots compared to West Ham's 3. But this was the most extraordinary stat of the night. Rodri attempted 188 passes and completed 178 of them, which is the same number of passes completed by the entire West Ham team.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, that tells a story, doesn't it? Actually, with those stats, though, Rodri set the Premier League record for passes attempted and completed, which is incredible.
Was it Jorginho before that, I think, something?
Yeah, but Jorginho, I think that might also have been against West Ham.
it was.
Ooh.
It was. There's a pattern emerging here.
I didn't see that game, and frankly, that nothing would induce me to watch a second of it. Just Manchester City passing it and passing it and passing it and sometimes scoring, and West Ham running and running and running. And
and fans shouting, Mansour, Mansour, Mansour.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great, isn't it?
And the odd banner saying, like, down with UEFA and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we need to discuss a few matters off the pitch. Let's talk about West Ham first of all. They've lifted the ban on Cameron Robson, which, just to remind you, is the fan who wore a T-shirt protesting against the board as he acted as one of the official flag wavers. You'll remember he is now going to be able to attend West Ham games for the rest of the season.
You can't be punished twice for the same offence.
And back to Manchester City and their UEFA charge. Of course, this is not going away. City chief executive Ferran.
It's neither charge, it's a verdict.
Okay,
the verdict has been given. It's a verdict.
Let me discuss this to wind you up, and then I'm going to let you go.
No. Just to say, it's a verdict. It's not alleged charges.
Okay.
It's a verdict.
Ferran Soriano has basically given an interview to City's own website. He says, based on our experience and our perception, this seems to be less about justice and more about politics. Of course, a lot of people come now and say, well, what were you expecting? This is the way it works. You sort of expected a negative outcome the way the system is designed. But we didn't believe that. We worked very hard. We provided the evidence. But in the end, this FFP investigatory chamber relied more on out-of-context stolen emails than all the other evidence we provided of what actually happened. And I think it's normal that we feel like we feel. So, I mean, it strikes a slightly different tone, far less aggressive than their initial reaction, but I mean, you're eye rolling, Philippe.
Yeah, because first of all, I think we should treat all these kind of statements with a little, with a pinch of salt, or the bag of salt, or the truck full of salt that it deserves. I think we're in a situation where, unfortunately, part of the British media is behaving towards Manchester City like part of the Westminster lobby was behaving with sources in Number 10. We all knew it was Dominic Cummings, and they were taking what he was saying at face value and reproducing it without questioning it. And I don't think that we should be doing this. It's quite extraordinary, I think I have to say. I mean, they have got a great PR operation in place, that's for sure. They've got some people who are quite happy to regurgitate what is being told to them, exactly like Number 10 had people ready to regurgitate what they were told. And I think we should let justice follow its course. That's what they want. They say we want a verdict from an independent body. By the way, the adjudicatory chamber of the ICFC is an independent body, which people should be reminded of, and they will get it. So why not let justice follow its course and stop portraying themselves as victims when they've been found guilty?
I thought the in-house interview was pretty funny. They got if you haven't seen it, they got Soriano to sit down with some, you know, reporter or presenter from the club's own TV channel. And he's going, right, well, all right, Ferran. I mean, first of all, why are we here? Why are we here? Like, you know, it wasn't Paxman, put it that way. And what exactly is a financial fair play? And how have we fallen foul of it? And, it's PR. It's attempting to muddy the waters. It's communicative diarrhea, almost. I think this has been City's tactic right from the start, that instead of answering any of the charges in any kind of substance, their approach has been to discredit, to obfuscate, to try and attack the legitimacy of the entire investigation and the motives of those involved, rather than addressing the substance of the allegations. And there have been a large proportion of their own fans and a small proportion of the media who have just been prepared to swallow this wholesale.
I didn't really see the point of that interview. I mean, it was some sort of sweeping statements. Wasn't asked any difficult questions or to justify any of the statements he was making. But I suppose Jonathan's exactly right. It helps to further obfuscate, muddy the waters, and further convince the more fanatical elements of Manchester City's support that everyone is out to get them, and when in fact they're not. You know, we will see what happens. And que also, sera, sera.
And they keep saying, oh, we've been singled out. And it's like, well, no, actually, a far bigger club than you was singled out, because it was Milan. Milan was kicked out of European competitions for a season because of breaches to the financial fair play rules. Milan is a bigger club than Manchester City, sorry. So don't say it's directed at you. And other clubs, Fenerbahce, Galatasaray, FC Sion, have been punished. It's not so whataboutery, should get out of the way. And it's the what is also a pity is that there is a genuine debate around the way that financial fair play works. And yes, you can actually be of the opinion that the way it is set up at the moment, it is there not to protect the super elite, but one of its consequences is to protect the super elite. If you don't want to be
conspiracy. Entrench the super elite, really.
Sorry?
Entrench the super elite.
Absolutely. And you can be quite upset about that. And so you have every right to have this debate and to say that's not correct. But that doesn't change anything for what's happened and what is happening.
Go on.
No. But we should be able to have a conversation in which we can say, it's true, the FFP rules, there is a lot to be said about that. But that's been the case for years. And the fact that now we have got this verdict, which has been given, doesn't invalidate the discussion that we should be having. But we shouldn't be confusing both. And I think what they're doing is that they are making us or making trying to make the public think that it is the same issue, that, you know, in the end, they're actually right, they're victimized because they're fighting against the big guys, which is coming from a club which is financed by Abu Dhabi, is quite saying something.
That's it for part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Coming up, we'll look ahead to this weekend's Premier League action. Welcome to part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Premier League returning, full Premier League. Winter break is over. Players are sunned, if you like. And a big one in the potential battle for fourth and or fifth, obviously, depending on what's going on at Manchester City. This is a massive game for both Chelsea and Tottenham, both coming into this from midweek defeats. Spurs in the Champions League, Chelsea obviously to Manchester United. I mean, we've talked about both of these teams in depth in the pod today. How do you see this one going, Jonathan?
I think the turnaround, the short turnaround for Tottenham puts them at a really severe disadvantage. Mourinho was complaining about the scheduling after the game, where they have to play Wednesday night and then Saturday 12:30. And actually, to be fair, he does have a point about that. It's brutal. That said, he will have something up his sleeve.
Troy Parrott.
Oh yeah, Troy Parrott for 90 minutes.
He'd have Parrott on his shoulder.
Ooh.
Hey. I think Chelsea are porous enough and I guess toothless enough up front that Tottenham have a pretty decent chance of finding their way through.
But they're both porous and toothless, though, aren't they? So
it's a big test of whether of their approach.
Who's the least gummy? Is that what?
Well, basically. Yeah.
Burnley, Bournemouth, Crystal Palace, Newcastle, Sheffield United, Brighton, Southampton, and Aston Villa making up all the 3 o'clock kickoffs on Saturday, and then a massive one: Leicester against Manchester City, third against second. Both teams with a little bit of a dip in form as well. City obviously won 3-1 in the reverse fixture. Can we see anything different here, Barry?
No, I thought perhaps because of all the palaver that was surrounding them off the field, City, if they had been playing anyone that was half decent, might have struggled in their first game back after the winter break. But because it was West Ham, it was kind of a free hit. They came through it easily. I think if Leicester were their first opponents with all this palaver going on off the field, then possibly it would be different. But Pep Guardiola set out his stall as regards, you know, I will be staying unless I get sacked, so he's dealt with that, and they're free to focus with on-field matters. I mean, on their day, Leicester could beat them, but
well, they've got the right arsenal, so to speak, to cause them problems. City have lost a lot of games this season. They do leave space at the back, which is something with Barnes and Vardy, you would imagine you can exploit that.
Expecting quite an open game.
Yes, and one to look forward to, absolutely.
On Sunday, Manchester United face Watford, Wolves against Norwich, and then another game with big consequences for the rest of the season for different reasons. Arsenal against Everton, Johnny.
Yeah, I guess it's two teams that started the season, you know, really quite poorly and have sort of pulled away from trouble. It's weird thinking about Arsenal in relegation trouble, but I mean they're only about 3 or 6 points clear of the relegation zone for a lot of the season. I mean it's the Mikel Arteta derby, isn't it? a lot of people
and the Theo Walcott derby
and the Theo Walcott derby and the Kevin Campbell derby
and the Alexi Wobbe derby.
Yeah. it should be.
Some seriously underwhelming derbies.
That's what I was thinking. I'm trying to think of another one.
Richard Wright derby.
Yes, indeed.
I guess it's one of those games that is another barometer of the modest progress that both sides have made. Arsenal under Arteta have been, like we said, a little bit more solid at the back. I guess it's a good test of how far they've gone against a team that is, frankly, of quite a similar standard to them at the moment.
I'd forgotten that Richard Wright had played for Arsenal.
Mm-hmm. He didn't do very much.
That's probably why I'd forgotten then.
Francis Cheffers derby.
Yes,
oh, yeah, I was. Francis Cheffers. Oh, blimey. Right, Monday night football. It doesn't get any easier for West Ham either because they have a trip to Anfield on the Monday night kickoff. I mean, we've talked a lot about West Ham already, and you're wincing, Philippe. So I think we're already predicting where that might go. Now then, Barcelona. Very interesting this week. Let me just explain this Martin Braithwaite situation. The scenario here is that on Monday, Barca were given special dispensation from the Spanish FA to make an emergency signing following an injury to Ousmane Dembélé, which will keep him out for the rest of the season. They were given 15 days to sign a player, as long as it was a forward, if they were a free agent or under contract at a La Liga club, so basically no purchases from abroad, and someone who will only be eligible to play in La Liga. So every player in La Liga has a release clause. So all Barcelona need to do is pick one, pay the release clause, and the selling club will have no way of stopping it go through. Barcelona have only got Lionel Messi, Antoine Griezmann and Ansu Fati available in their first team squad because they sold Malcolm last summer and Carlos Perez and Abel Ruiz at the end of January. So it could be argued that this situation is of their own making. They basically have gone out and decided upon Leganés striker Martin Braithwaite. Leganés second bottom, tied with last place on 19 points, 2 points from safety. Braithwaite is their top scorer. And Leganés have basically, this is the kicker, have basically been told they can't replace him. This is bonkers, isn't it? How is this possible?
This is so disgraceful, I have no words. Honestly, it's just beyond me.
The rule only kicks in if a player's out for at least, was it 5 months or 6 months?
Five months.
And so obviously then they ask, but well, how long is Dembélé going to be out for? Oh, well, I think about 5 months, I think. All right, well, off you go. I mean, Barcelona's recruitment over the last few seasons has been absolutely shocking. The whole pursuit of a striker in January was kind of ridiculous, and the rules should not be allowing them to paper over this at the expense of a much better run rival.
Why can't Leganés sign anyone?
They've just been told they're not allowed to replace because they're not in the same situation as Barcelona are.
Right, yeah.
So they're screwed, basically, which seems deeply unfair. Now, we've managed to get through this entire pod only mentioning VAR a couple of times, which is impressive. Round of applause to all of us. However, Arsene Wenger's been speaking about the offside rule at the Laureas Awards in Berlin. He's come out and said the most difficult issue people have with VAR is the offside rule, and that there is room to change the rule and not say that a part of a player's nose is offside, so you're offside because you can score with that. Instead, you will not be offside if any part of the body that can score a goal is in line with the last defender, even if other parts of the attacker's body are in front. That will sort it out, and you'll no longer have decisions about millimetres and a fraction of the attacker being in front of the defensive line. This is a suggestion which has come up several times, including on this podcast, but it feels like the wrong solution. What does anybody else think?
He's actually come back on this statement.
Well, FIFA have come back on this statement, yeah, basically saying it's not something that they have ratified.
He basically said, like, he's basically clarified. He's done, quite ironically, I did not see the incident on one of his own quotes.
Was he wearing his coat when he made this statement?
When he's made the same kind of mistake that Marco van Basten made time after time when he started to work for FIFA and not checking things properly or perhaps not understanding how things work, how the wheels of FIFA, and in this particular case of IFAB.
Difficult. It was in a panel discussion, wasn't it?
So he was
kind of talking off the cuff.
He's now saying that is one of the options which are on the table and so forth, which, by the way, I mean, looking at people who know far better about these sort of things, it appears it would sort out absolutely nothing, that you could have completely ridiculous situations with that kind of alteration to the rule as well.
Yeah, we'd just have new and different ways of having the same problem, if you know what I mean.
And people will always find ways of getting around it as well. Producer Jonathan makes a really good point. There will still be marginal calls by millimetres. The line will just have to be moved. And this thing about giving the advantage back to the attacker, the average number of goals per game in the Premier League has kind of oscillated between 2.6 and 2.8 in the last decade or so. This season, it's standing at 2.76 per match. So, you know, the attackers are doing fine even with VAR.
It's exactly the same. 2.76, yes, absolutely the same.
Monsieur Wenger's proposal, though, would hand the advantage back to defenders at set pieces because they could just defend a lot deeper. And it doesn't sound like, and strangely for him, but it doesn't sound like he's thought it through. But I think maybe he was just thinking aloud and it's people have run with it more than they should have.
Yeah.
It appears that there won't be any changes before 2021 anyway now.
Mm. Now, it's all kicking off in a battle of the French midfield legends, Philippe. Can you remind us what Deschamps versus Cantona is all about?
We've only got a few minutes or a few seconds, so I won't go to the bottom of it. It's very complicated. It's a very old food.
A feud.
But I like food. We all remember what, you know, Cantona said about Deschamps before the game. This was in 1996.
The water carrier.
Mm-hmm. There have been grumblings between the two for a long time. But this is. I have to say, I entirely blame our great friend Owen Gibson for this, because it is all because of an interview that Eric Cantona gave to The Guardian back in 2016, in which he used some words which I will quote, so I cannot be libeled. This cannot be deemed libelous. And he was basically saying that, talking about Benzema not being in the French team and Ben Arfa not being in the French team, he said, Deschamps is such a French name. He's perhaps the only Frenchman to have a real French, the French person to have a real French name. Nobody in his family has mixed up with anybody else, just like the Mormons in the United States of America. So I'm not surprised that he's used the Benzema situation. You might remember he had some problems in the past with the French justice about Mathieu Valbuena's sex tape. But they have got origins, which means ethnic background. So I think I have a right to say that. And he was asked directly, was he saying that there might be an element of racial discrimination? And he said, well, maybe yes, maybe no, why not? So, and I could carry on like that. So Deschamps decided to sue Cantona for libel. Amazingly enough, this is going to come to court next week, 28th of February, in Paris. And apparently Didier Deschamps will be there in court to present his side of the case. I very much doubt that Eric Cantona will leave Lisbon to be present at this hearing, but I could never put anything past Eric, I must say.
No.
It's an early flight for you, Mr. Cantona.
Philippe, also, your regular section, it now seems to be Gianni Infantino.
No, it's actually very funny. I mean, very funny. UEFA As we know, and FIFA don't get on very well at all at the moment. There's all these things about creation of the Club World Cup and all these sort of things. UEFA has just signed a pact of cooperation with CONMEBOL, which is the South American Confederation, which is seen by absolutely everybody as a means to create a block against FIFA. And Gianni threw a tantrum and he decided we were supposed to have a FIFA council meeting in Asunción, in Paraguay. And so he decided, I'm going to cancel it and have a video conference instead. So I'm not going to talk to these people in person. I was thinking, actually, maybe that would be a means to save quite a lot of money for FIFA in the future. Maybe they could have all their FIFA council conferences by video.
I can't see that catching on somehow, but...
No, I don't either. But Jenny's not happy. He's not a happy bunny at all at the moment.
He's not happy that often, really, is he?
Well, he's less Gianni. And less happy because the problem with CAF in Africa, with the problem with UEFA, the problem with CONMEBOL, oh my goodness.
Oh, he's a busy
stacking
man.
Stacking up.
Just finally, a shout out to the National Football Museum who've inducted Justin Fashanu into their Hall of Fame. He was the first male English professional player to come out as gay while still playing back in 1990. No top level players come out during their career since. Justin subsequently took his own life in 1998. His award was accepted by his niece, Amal Fashanu, who said, "The fact that Justin just got up and said, 'This is who I am, I'm going to respect myself and get others to respect me for who I am,' that is one of the most impressive things. And for him, as my uncle, I couldn't think of anything more honourable, and I look up to it every single day." Right, that's the end of this week's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Thank you for your time today, Philippe.
Thank you, Faye.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks.
Thanks, Baz.
And thank you, Faye.
And thank you for having me. Max is going to be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.